Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. September 11th, 2001 was a bad day for New York, for the NYPD. Two jets, a terror attack, towers down, thousands dead. If you heard the NYPD was doing everything it could to prevent another attack, you'd surely have been relieved. But if you heard the NYPD has been spying wholesale, deep and wide, on Muslim New Yorkers and Muslims well beyond New York, well, what would you say about that? This hour on Point, the NYPD and a question: how much policing is too much policing? There's been a furor in recent weeks over the NYPD's intelligence operations, as they're called, because of a series of investigative pieces published by the Associated Press. Those reports have described very widespread surveillance. Jethro Eisenstein has been following the AP reports closely. He's a civil rights lawyer with a big brief in New York City. He is charged by the court with monitoring New York police investigations as part of a decades-old class action lawsuit called the Handshoe Case. He joins us from New York. Jethro Eisenstein, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Would you please give us a sense of the scale of what's been going on in the NYPD's surveillance of Muslims in and far around New York?
Well, my information is based on a series of articles written by AP investigative reporters and Len Levitt, who used to be with Newsday. The series of articles started being published in August of 2011, And they were based on interviews with more than 40 current and former NYPD officers.
Right.
And the articles described the program of widespread surveillance by the NYPD of the Muslim communities in New York. The first thing that they apparently did was they located all the mosques in New York as well as social gathering places. And then they started sending NYPD operatives into all the mosques and into all the social gathering places. They described the operatives in the mosques as mosque crawlers, And they described the operation as raking the coals. Their job was to listen and to report in writing about what people said. The AP articles also report that they infiltrated Muslim student associations at colleges and universities in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, and that they conducted similar operations going through the mosques and social gathering places in Newark, New Jersey, and other cities around New Jersey and around New York State. The AP articles were documented with NYPD documents, reports indicating the kind of information that these operatives were gathering and recording in written reports. And to give you a sense of the scale of this operation, the AP found and reported about some testimony by Assistant Commissioner Lawrence Sanchez, who was brought to New York City from the CIA after September 11, 2001.
Right.
He testified in Congress that the operative principle of their surveillance program was to start appreciating, this is a quote, what most people would say would be non-criminal, would be innocuous-looking behaviors that could easily be argued in a Western democracy, especially in the United States, to be protected by First and Fourth Amendment rights, but not to look at them in the vacuum, but to look across to them as potential precursors to terrorism.
Can we get a sense of exactly what they were doing? I mean, the ambition of this was very large. Of course, the attacks on 9/11 were very large. But in the aftermath of that, David Cohen, the Deputy Commissioner for Intelligence with the NYPD, is reported by the AP saying he wanted a source inside every mosque within a 250-mile radius of New York. And it wasn't only inside the mosque. They were surveilling outside, but planting cameras that would watch the mosque all the time. They'd go by with cameras and take up every license plate number of worshippers parked around the mosque, I'm reading here from the AP, Mr. Eisenstein?
Right. And they were also recording names of people who were doing nothing more than attending services at mosques and those who actually spoke. What they said was recorded, no matter how innocuous and how protected it might be. Cohn's aspiration really says it all. His goal was to have the NYPD have a presence in every social gathering place for Muslims in not only within New York City, but as you say, in a 250-mile radius from New York City.
Let's hear what the mayor of New York has to say about this. He's been defending the NYPD. Here he is over the weekend, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg on WORAM radio, his weekly call-in show there. And here he was talking about the police department, saying it's just doing its job.
Our first objective, our primary objective, is to prevent things from happening. That's why I call police and fire our first preventers as opposed to our first responders. We've got to do everything that the law permits us to do to prevent another terror attack, and we cannot forget that.
And Mayor Bloomberg emphasized, this is again over the weekend in response to this drumbeat of reports, that everything that the police department's intelligence unit has done has been within the law, he says.
Everything the New York City Police Department has done is legal, it is appropriate, it is constitutional. They are permitted to travel beyond the borders of New York City to investigate cases. They can look at websites, they can watch television to detect unlawful activities or where there might be unlawful activities to get leads. We don't target individuals based on race or religion.
We don't target individuals, he says, based on a race or religion, and it's all legal. We'll look at both of those. Jethro Eisenstein, please stand by in New York. Also from New York right now with us is Haroon Mogal. He's an American-born Muslim, Pakistani descent. He's lived in New York since 1998. He was walking to classes at NYU when the World Trade Center was struck on 9/11. He's now a doctoral candidate at Columbia University. Haroon Mogal, thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You must have been following all these news reports about just how widespread the surveillance has been. I guess my first question for you is, when you hear these reports, are you surprised? Or as a member of this Muslim community, has it been obvious to you that there's been a lot of surveillance, infiltration, call it what you will?
I think disappointingly, we're not that surprised. I think what we're more surprised by is, just like the quote you played from Mayor Bloomberg, the kind of defenses that are being used, claiming that people aren't targeted on race or religion, which is based on the AP reports, entirely false. What really hurts, I think, more than anything surprising, is that the people who have said they will work with law enforcement, who want to and do work with law enforcement and city authorities and federal authorities, are also the ones being spied on. So it's a case of saying that we're valued members of the community while behind our backs we're seen as targets, as suspicious individuals.
Is it sort of commonly presumed now, if you're in a mosque in New York or nearby, I mean, this has gone way into New Jersey, Newark, and all over the place, is it presumed if you're there that you may have been watched coming in or that someone that you're speaking with within the mosque may be planted there or in the pay of the NYPD?
I think these conversations have been happening a lot among American Muslim leaders, these questions of to what extent are we being watched? For what reasons are we being watched? I think what's really shocking to people is the scale of the operation. So you mentioned this 250-mile range. We're talking about college campuses from Yale to UPenn. It's really the range, the scope, and the audacity of it in terms of the defenses that are given that more than anything are surprising and disappointing to Muslims in New York and in the area.
The president of Yale complaining, saying, come on, I mean, don't be infiltrating our Muslim student associations. Let's have some sense of balance here. But Jethro Eisenstein, the police department, not really apologizing for this. And you heard there the mayor not saying, we've got a job to do. We have to stop terrorism. And he said, it's not targeted by race or religion, and it's all legal. What do you say, Mr. Eisenstein?
I have to disagree with the mayor. It's not legal. And I also disagree with him as a matter of policy. But let me first address how it is not correct to say that it's legal. There is a set of rules, and the reason why I'm on this program, I guess, is that I am and have been for the last 40 years one of the lawyers for the plaintiff class in the Hanshu case, which started about NYPD surveillance during the Vietnam War, and which resulted in a set of rules that limited, to which the police department agreed, that limited surveillance of political activity in New York. Those rules were modified by the court at the request of the NYPD after 9/11, but they are still rules and they are enforceable. And what they're doing violates those rules, because one of the things that they're doing is that they are recording in police files what people are saying at mosques, what people are saying in gathering places that has absolutely no relationship to terrorism or even the criminal activity of any kind. They're recording the most innocuous things with people's names associated with them. And so police dossiers are being created simply based on speech and based particularly on the fact that the group of people who are being watched are Muslims.
And when the mayor says we've got to do this because the public expects us to protect them from another attack, what do you say, Jethro Eisenstein?
I say that there has there has not been any attack in Minneapolis, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and any other large city which does not have a program like this.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point, and we're talking this hour about New York's blanket surveillance of Muslims in the city, and it turns out far beyond, and charges that the NYPD has gone too far in wholesale spying on Muslim lives. Here's a Muslim in Newark, New Jersey, and of course the net went there and further. There's a resident, Mohammed El-Siufi, interviewed by Al Jazeera English Television last week, and he was expressing his frustration as a Muslim living in the United States in Newark at news reports that his mosque was being watched by the NYPD.
The simple people who are working hard in a gas station or in a grocery store or a supermarket just to make barely the living, and then they spy on them because they are Muslims? Why that?
Why that, he asked. And here, after the AP reported the NYPD was watching Muslims in Newark, among other places, Newark's mayor, Cory Booker, was put on the defensive. Here he is on the Newark Today radio show last week, saying he didn't know what was going on in his own city.
We didn't understand or didn't know. We're not made aware of the scope and the scale of what was going on. And again, I want to caution, we don't know what the provocation was from the NYPD. So my sole purpose right now, beyond asking for a top-to-bottom investigation, not by my police, I would really like to see the Attorney General, as would the governor, as has United States Senator Menendez. Everybody's asking, hey, let's get all the facts. But my immediate concern really is the Muslim community here in Newark, New Jersey.
Let's get all the facts. There are a lot of facts on the table right now, thanks to the Associated Press, and it shows a very, very wide, deep net of surveillance here. Is it right? Is it too much? New York City Police Commissioner here, Ray Kelly, was on the PBS Charlie Rose show, argued that his department's intelligence-gathering efforts are not surveillance.
What we will do is follow specific leads. In other words, indication of perhaps unlawful activity. We will follow that lead. We may follow that lead with an undercover person. But we can also gather information. Now, this may be too much information.
Yeah, it may be. Follow specific leads. We'll look at that. Jethro Eisenstein is with us. He's a civil rights attorney in New York, one of the attorneys in the plaintiff case in the Hanshu case. This is an old class action lawsuit against the NYPD for spying on protesters and political dissidents. He's responsible by a court order to monitor police investigations. He's with us today from New York. Harun Mogul is with us, American-born, Pakistani descent. He was right down walking to class at NYU when the World Trade Center was struck in 2001. He's a doctoral candidate at Columbia University now and watching what's going on with Muslims in and around New York, author of The Order of Light, a novel forecasting young Muslims in the Middle East protesting against their regimes. He's got a good handle on what's going on in and beyond the United States. And with us right now from Paris is Christopher Dickey, old friend of On Point, author of Securing the City Inside America's Best Counterterror Force, the NYPD. He's in Paris bureau chief and Middle East editor for Newsweek and the Daily Beast. Gets back to New York regularly, continues to cover the NYPD's intelligence unit. Christopher Dickey, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, it's my pleasure, Tom.
So you wrote this big book, Securing the City, which was pretty laudatory, by and large, of the NYPD for their response to 9/11. Now the AP is going, you know, fiber by fiber here and laying out what clearly the editors there think they're displaying as a pattern of too much surveillance. What do you see happening here, Christopher?
Well, most of what's in the AP reports actually was in the book. It's just a question of the times changing. In 2009, when the book came out, I raised all these questions about whether the NYPD was getting too close to the legal line. In fact, I was on a panel with Ray Kelly in 2009, and generally he said the book was okay, but it should have had a chapter on the lawyers because, in fact, they have huge batteries of lawyers that reassure Ray Kelly and Mayor Bloomberg that what they're doing is legal, although a lot of those arguments are legalistic. Whether they are really within the spirit of the Constitution is another matter. But in 2009, as recently as that, people still felt greatly relieved that they were being protected by the NYPD. Now we have an environment where, starting just before 9/11, the AP with Lynn Levitt, who hates Ray Kelly and hates the administration of the NYPD, started coming out with these reports based on not on 40 NYPD interviews, but on 40 law enforcement interviews, which certainly included several people with the FBI or formerly with the FBI, and they hate the NYPD too.
Because it's kind of getting into their turf a little bit with its very...
Oh, yes, absolutely. There are these huge and really very messy turf battles between the FBI and the NYPD. But is there reason for concern about the way the NYPD has handled its intelligence functions in counterterrorism? Yes, there absolutely is. At the end of the book, I felt reasonably confident that Ray Kelly and David Cohen had not gone way over the line of what people in New York City would accept. But I think to myself, if there were somebody else running the police department, say a Bernard Carrick, a former police commissioner who was eventually indicted, and they had the amount of power that Ray Kelly has, then I think that would... It certainly raises questions. So I think there are definite civil liberties questions to be raised about this.
I want to take those to our other guest, Christopher, but describe to us just how ambitiously the NYPD responded after 9/11, who they brought in, what kind of people, what kind of operations they ramped up.
Well, what they decided after 9/11 was that they could not depend on the federal government to protect New York. So what Kelly did was start to put together machinery within the NYPD that would have enough of an intelligence operation to actually be preemptive, to actually go out and find out where terrorists were organizing, including overseas. It's not just out in Newark,
right,
New Jersey. I mean, there is an NYPD person here in the intelligence division of the French police. There are NYPD people in Tel Aviv, in London, really, literally, all over the world. And their business is to try and figure out what's going on in the world of terrorists and at very specific levels, including a lot of human intelligence, and use that to prevent new attacks in New York City. My interest in writing the book originally was not to be laudatory about the police, but it was obvious to me that the best way to fight terrorism was not to invade Afghanistan and occupy it and invade Iraq and occupy it, that probably something needed to be done at an intelligence level that was much more low-key. And in fact, the only institution that was doing that certifiably and effectively when I worked on the book was the NYPD.
I want to bring that to Jethro Eisenstein and Haroon Mogul. Let's get our listeners in here as well. First, South Carolina looking on at the situation in New York and beyond. Columbia, South Carolina, Sheldon's calling. Sheldon, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I can agree with, you know, your guest more, agree with the gentleman, because I'm former law enforcement, and, you know, now not really too many reprisals can be taken against me, but case in point, when I was in the Air Force after September 11th, and I had been in Kuwait three months before, you know, the United States got attacked.
Okay.
But what happened after September 11th was we were actually told when we were on the gates, you know, out at Charleston Air Force Base, that we were to sort of stop, you know, the individuals that had like a Middle Eastern or Arabic name and just write, you know, start compiling an itinerary of them like that. And, personally,
so not in Kuwait, you know, but right there in Charleston, South Carolina.
An African-American.
Yeah.
You know, that's the part I took personal as a police officer. I could understand that was my job, but that just didn't make it right just because I had the right to do it. And it was happening. It was definitely happening.
So when you hear about the NYPD having the ambition of having somebody inside every mosque within 250 miles of New York as a law enforcement, former enforcement officer, does it sound reasonable to you or like profiling?
No, it sounds like profiling. And even to go back farther in history,
yeah.
You know, because like my dad did 30 years in the military, you know, mm-hmm. Vietnam vet. And when we lived in Seattle, Washington, you know, of course, after the attack on Pearl Harbor, there was a lot of innocent, you know, Japanese. They were interned in concentration camps. And, you know, some just because of their name, you know, they had a Japanese name. They had all the property taken, you know, name brought down, and they went from, you know, doing well to just, you know, being thrown in, you know, prison. And there's a lot of innocent Muslims, not the radical types or anything, that are going to be suffering. When they do this big sweep, this dragnet, they're going to get some people hot and bothered that don't have anything to do with it. And for them, what I would say, as a police officer, you have to do your job. Of course, you know, mm-hmm. I'm not knocking a police officer for their job, but when you cross the line and everything, it's your right as citizens, as groups, to organize and say, wait a minute, you know, this is going too far. I understand you're trying to keep our country safe and all that, but you sort of like, you know, you stepped off the cliff on that one, you know, and I know I'm going to take a lot of heat for that.
Sheldon, I appreciate your call. Jethro Eisenstein, there's a sympathetic ear here that says, you know, he's been there, he's been asked to do this, he didn't like it. On the other hand, nobody liked 9/11, and nobody wanted to be, you know, caught up in political correctness when it came to stopping another attack like that. So how do we sort out safety versus the Constitution, freedom versus caution? How do you draw the line through here?
Well, the first thing I'd like to say in response to what Mr. Hickey said is that
Dickey, get the
Dickey,
name right.
Sorry,
Jethro.
Sorry,
Dickey.
Dickey.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Said is that the difference between the FBI and the New York City Police Department is that the FBI and, for that matter, the CIA operate under oversight from the appropriate committees of Congress. There is no oversight for the NYPD, and I don't have sufficient confidence in the difference between Ray Kelly, the current commissioner, and Bernard Kerik to say that I'm prepared to put these decisions that effectively treat Muslim identity as inherently probative of disloyalty, I don't want to put that in his hands without any oversight. And I think that these programs that are going on, I guess it's true that that the pendulum has shifted, but what that means is that from a position where people were sufficiently traumatized by the events of September 11th so as not to be able to make careful distinctions like this, that has receded a little bit so that people are again able to think about whether these are appropriate things to do. And you have to remember that the government, you know, Justice Brandeis said about a zillion years ago, the government is the omnipresent teacher. And by treating Muslims as terrorists, by branding Muslims as people whose exercise of First Amendment rights should be viewed with suspicion, we're legitimating that kind of approach in the population at large. And that's a very dangerous thing to do. So one has to be very careful about programs like this. I understand the importance of security. It is important. I understand that police work is difficult. But it is... this program is beyond the line because it simply says that if you're a Muslim, you're likely to be a terrorist and we're going to treat you as such.
Christopher Dickey, Haroon Mogul, I'll bring that to you. Let me get one caller here first, John Cheshire, Connecticut. Thanks, John. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I think this issue is way overblown. We've been attacked and we continue to be threatened. I mean, how much happened after Korans were burned, you know.
In Afghanistan,
the population comes out after us.
In Afghanistan.
The other thing is, we are not, minorities and foreigners are not the only people that get profiled. I was profiled when I was a teenager. I was getting onto a plane in the 70s to fly to school. I had dark hair and a mustache. They kept me off the plane, pulled me off into one of those on-ramps, and frisked me up and down, took my suitcase all apart. And when I asked why, I said, oh, you probably fit the profile, you know, for a hijacker for the day.
But, John, how would you feel if there were, police car sitting outside your church or synagogue or, you know, the corner store where you shop, or there was a police agent inside your house of worship or your social setting. I don't know, your bowling alley. If you were looking over your shoulder in all those locations, having your license plate number swept up, would that be all right to you?
Well, yeah. If I wasn't doing anything wrong, there shouldn't be a problem. And look at it this way. You look at some of these other countries, how do you think you'd be treated if you went there to some Middle Eastern country?
But isn't the point this is supposed to be the United States, where we have a constitution which gives us freedoms and liberties? Haroon Mogul, do you feel, as a member of the American Muslim community, that those constitutional civil liberties are being fully extended to you or not?
Well, I have to respond to what John said. If I'm doing nothing wrong, I wouldn't mind. I mean, that's the logic of a dictatorship, right? If you're, you know, you shouldn't mind the fact that the government is watching and doing everything you say, the people you talk to, the places you go. But the fact is that when you give government or you give law enforcement this range of power, they don't give it back. It's just a start. And the fact of the matter is that for American Muslims, we feel like the canary in the coal mine. I mean, Mayor Bloomberg does an iftar dinner, a Ramadan dinner, every year. And a few years ago, it came out that one of the guests who came to this dinner, who by definition is the kind of guy who wants to work with the government, who's
right.
been vetted by the city to come attend this, who's there to present his institution, organization, community, what have you, was being spied on. So the fact of the matter is, it's not if I did nothing wrong, I wouldn't mind the government watching me. I mean, the fundamental principle of the Constitution is that government has to be checked by the people and that you don't get spied on unless there's clear evidence you're doing something wrong.
Christopher,
we don't cast a wide net and just let kind of everyone watch everything. And I think that's what a lot of American Muslims feel.
But then the mayor has said that, look, after the 93 bombing attempt in New York after 2011, we're not comfortable anymore just sitting back. On the other hand, Christopher Dickey, the police commissioner, Ray Kelly, and Mayor Bloomberg both say very emphatically that police only follow legitimate leads of criminal activity. They do not conduct preventive surveillance of ethnic communities. Do those assertions sound credible at this point to you, Christopher?
No, I think that's. I think there's been a lot of exaggeration and some special pleading on all sides. First of all, I don't think you should have people on the show saying that this is all about rounding people up. Nobody's being rounded up. There are no roundups of Muslims. This is not about keeping 100% surveillance all the time on every mosque, which is what the AP reports seem to suggest. What they are doing is they do check on mosques. They do check on groups of young Muslims, especially what they call groups of guys. Why? Because typically when you get groups of guys organizing and talking about jihad and talking about how they're going to start blowing things up, you want to be around where you hear them say these things.
What if they're not talking about blowing things up, there anyway?
Well, then, in fact, since you're not rounding people up, one of the things you determine is that you're not hearing anything like that at this mosque, or you're not hearing anything like that more often in the bookstore attached to the mosque. When you do hear it, then you want to be in a position to act on it. And what they do, and now who hears it? Now who hears it? Now this is where the special pleading comes in on the other side. Who hears it are often young people, men and women, usually men, who've applied for a job at the NYPD, who are Muslims themselves, and who, even before they go into the police academy, are pulled out of the recruiting line, as it were, and asked if they want to work on special duty. And then they're trained as undercover officers.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about New York City's blanket surveillance of an awful lot of Muslims in the city, and well beyond, it turns out, charges that the NYPD has gone too far in wholesale spying on Muslim lives. Let's go to Bernard in West Hartford, Connecticut. Bernard, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. This is just so simple to me. I can't stand it. I mean, this is so sad, it's almost laughable. I understand that 9/11 was a serious problem, but I also remember hearing my father talking about Kristallnacht, the night of glass in Germany back in the 1930s. In every synagogue was an SS member taking notes on who talks about what, who looks about what, because the Jews were clearly responsible for the Germans losing World War I. It was a terrible thing. It was an awful thing.
That was the Nazi line, yeah.
Yeah, so that was their line, and it was unfortunate what was happening in Germany during the 1930s. The point is, they focused on a group of people as if that group of people somehow made the Germans lose the war. I mean, this is just so simple to me. Catholic priests have been known pedophiles, and a lot of their assaults happened in rectories. Now, are we going to start putting up cameras outside rectories to start filming what children and what parents go in and out of the rectories? How would the Catholics feel if this started happening to them? In their parish parking lots, they got cameras now. They're going to start noticing who goes in and who goes out, who's talking to who, how many Catholic kids are all standing around talking together.
Yeah, Bernard, we got it. You could put a camera on a whole lot of people if you got revved up to do that. I take your point. Here we've got a lot of response online. Eric says on the web, this is, we talked about raking the coals. In other words, one of the phrases that was used by the NYPD for their activity in looking through mosques. Eric says, raking the coals is what you do when you want to build a fire, not to put it out. We'll talk to Haroon about that. Janelle says, no, they did not go too far. Any location suspected of teaching and encouraging violence against us needs to be investigated and shut down if it's proved that it's planning terrorism against the American people. But then there's the issue of where's the line there. Jethro, let me come back to you. I mean, Christopher Dickey is saying, look, there are reasonable precautions that can be taken here. So let's please come back to the line and where it stands, and I hope not just within the particular rules laid down for New York City after what went on there in the 60s, but under the U.S. Constitution. We've got people listening all over the country wondering about their own communities. Where's the line, Jethro?
Well, I can't help a little special pleading. There are rules that govern New York City, and New York City's police department is what's at issue, and New York City's police department is over the line. The Supreme Court said in 1972 that the passive collection of information is not a violation of the Constitution, that a person who simply knows that information has been collected about him or her does not have a legal claim that can be brought to court.
And that's what New York is saying. Look, we can go out into public and we can collect information.
But in New York, which agreed to a set of rules because of a long history of going over the line, New York is the paradigm place. And New York has a set of rules. And New York, which has the most aggressive program of a local police department that I'm aware of, also is subject to particular rules which it is currently violated. So it's hard for me to not to focus on the local police department that's actually acting in this situation and respond to the contention that they're not violating the law by what they're doing.
But you are a civil rights attorney. Let me just ask you, are you saying by that if these things went on at this scale and this depth elsewhere in the country, not the NYPD, it would be all right, according to the Supreme Court?
According to the Supreme Court, the passive collection of information, which does not result in people being injured by it, by bringing it to the attention of employers or things like that, is not something that you can come into court about. That's different from whether, as a matter of policy, that's an appropriate thing for local police departments to do. I can only address myself to what the current state of the law is, that the passive collection of activity is not unconstitutional.
Christopher Dickey, I mean, maybe we just have a misapprehension of what American freedoms are comprised of here.
Well, but this is precisely why I was cautioning, Tom, about mm-hmm. going from passive collection of information to massive roundups to the Kristallnacht. I mean, that's typical, sort of, I hate to say this, but that's typical talk radio. And
well,
that's not what's
let's be
going
careful
on
here, because I don't know who mentioned roundup, but roundup has nothing to do with this. Of course, there are occasional arrests over the course of time, but I think I was careful to say that what is going on here is very widespread surveillance.
Well, and actually, Jethro may or may not be aware of this, but he certainly should be aware of it, and it's more than a little disturbing. There were very bright people in the police intelligence division, the NYPD intelligence division, who looked at the situation in New York and said, if we don't arrest people, the civil liberties types won't be able to do anything with us, because that's the question of causing mm-hmm. harm that mm-hmm. Jethro is talking about. So the intelligence division, in fact, almost never arrests anybody. You've probably heard of CompStat, the accounting system for arrests and detentions. Yep. And that kind of thing. In the NYPD, it's in other parts of the New York Police Department, it's now become infamous because there's a question of inflating numbers. The Intelligence Division has 500 detectives. They don't have to do anything with CompStat because they don't record arrests. That's not what they do. They're all about penetrating organizations, finding these groups of guys, two, three, four guys who've decided they want to be jihadists. Maybe they want to go to Pakistan or Afghanistan. Maybe they want to do it all at home. And once they've identified them, disrupting their organization, their group, not usually by arresting and detaining and booking them. In fact, quite the contrary.
But Christopher, you're watching all this. I appreciate how much you've written and learned about this, Christopher, but you watch it as an American citizen, too. And being based there in Europe, you see what other countries do when it comes to this kind of policing. I mean, are you – I don't know if you've read every line of the AP reports. I've read pretty much all of it. And, you know, it's not just a broad brush. They've gone very carefully through these activities, and it does add up to an awful lot of what seems 10 years
ago. I think, first of all, a lot of it took place at a time – it did take place at a time much earlier in the decade – when there was a much more of a sense of let's just do anything that we can possibly do. Mm-hmm. Even then, Kelly was very, very careful to deal with the Hanshew agreements and the Hanshew guidelines, which is why I would say to Mr. Eisenstein, you know, if what you say is true, and it may well be, it will be tested in the courts and you will win if the Hanshew guidelines remain in force as you interpret them. But I don't believe that's been tested in the court and that the rulings have been in the favor of the civil liberties lawyers. I personally, as an American, I have doubts about all of this. I think it's all potentially very, very sinister. But I think in terms of the Muslim community in the United States, there are a lot more serious things to worry about, actually, than NYPD surveillance. I mean, you could worry about Newt Gingrich. You could worry about Rick Santorum, who have adopted a line of debate and discussion of Muslims and Muslim issues that smacks of Geert Wilders, the demagogue of Holland, who says that all Islam is fascism and that all Muslims are dangerous. That is a real problem, but that is not what the NYPD is doing.
But presumably, if they were empowered, what they might have in mind is NYPD-style policing right across the country. Jethro,
Which is precisely why I say it's very specific, and I think what Mr. Eisenstein is doing is exactly right, and I agree with him completely. From his point of view, you absolutely should not say, yeah, Ray Kelly's a great guy, Bernie Kerik isn't, and therefore it's okay when Kelly's there, and we'll just adjust the laws later, because you can't. The laws have to be well-defined for anybody who holds the office, and I agree with that.
Jethro, I'll bring that to you. I want to get Rachel here from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, on the air. Hi, Rachel, you're on.
Hi. There have been lots of things that have been well stated, but I'm both a lawyer and a minister, a Christian minister.
Okay.
And I am horrified by many things these days, including what's happening in New York. But I also bring a different perspective as to what this has as a part of the whole. My daughter, who was raised as a Christian, married a Pakistani. They are Muslim.
Okay.
My two grandchildren are just less than two and just now four. And they've had kids go screaming away from them in the public park in Colorado because my daughter wears a hijab.
The scarf,
and,
okay.
You know, I think all these things, you know, we said never again. I'm old enough to remember never again. We would never do what we did to the Japanese. And yet we so easily slip back into it, you know, when we get threatened. And it's just all a part, you know, this targeting of people because of their religion. It's a horrifying thing to me.
Yeah, and we can see that it's very personal. It comes right into your family, Rachel. I appreciate your call. I mean, Jethro Eisenstein, Christopher Dickey says, let's draw careful lines here. And if you've got problems with this, under the Hanshew guidelines, rules that have been laid down for some decades now, you know, take it to the court, and if it's wrong, they'll stop it.
Well, we are in the court, and the court has ruled that the rules are binding. And I'm looking now, as we speak, at an intelligence note brought to Commissioner Kelly, which is a compilation of statements made by named individuals in mosques in February of 2006, all of which are entirely protected by the First Amendment. And each of these people on this intelligence note brought to Commissioner Kelly has said things, is now part of a police dossier because of protected First Amendment activities. It's not necessary, nor is it appropriate, nor is it prudent to wait until there is a roundup. And our nation's history is littered with roundups of unpopular people.
But why wait? Why even consider a roundup? I mean, aren't you saying that the surveillance currently underway or that has been used is beyond the rules? So why hasn't it been stopped? Was it not known?
We're pushing back right now. We are in court right now about this program and seeking to get more information about it so that we can go back to court and have the judge declare that it goes beyond the rules. My point about the roundups is that what's necessary to do is to be vigilant about this kind of behavior because it can move. It's not just talk radio to say that a program of targeting people based on their religion can morph into a roundup. It has happened in this country, and I'm about trying to stop it from happening.
But it is important to say that's not what's being alleged here, but there's a lot that's being written about here by the Associated Press. Haroon Mogal, what's your sense of how over time this is affecting attitudes within the Muslim community, the Muslim American community? I mean, are people being alienated by a fear that they may be watched or listened to all the time? Or is there a sense of understanding? I mean, I'm looking through the comments here gathered, and, you know, very often what's being said in the mosque that's being reported in these police documents, you've got imams asking for peaceful protest if they're calling for protest. Still, I wonder what the effect is over time, Haroon.
Well, you know, the question of roundup needs to be contextualized also in the case of the tens of thousands of Muslims who were basically just booted out of the country after 9/11, especially in New York City, immigrants who'd overstayed their visas. Amy Waldman has a novel just out, The Submission, that pretty accurately fictionalizes this kind of story and its traumatic effect on people. But really what needs to be said is that it doesn't take a roundup, right? If one person gets taken down for their views or is spied on, it puts a chill on everyone else. Right, so this is what Putin did with Khodorkovsky. Right, he put one guy in jail, and everyone else got the point. Don't step over this line. And I think Mr. Dickey is totally correct about what's going on in the GOP, Newt Gingrich, things like that. But at the same time, Ray Kelly sat for a 90-minute interview with this nonsensical documentary, The Third Jihad, which is an incredibly racist, anti-Muslim, bigoted film.
This was an orientation film for his.
Yeah, it was shown to about 1,500 officers, and. You know, again, the movie has a disclaimer at the beginning. This doesn't apply to all Muslims. But then, you know, the subsequent rest of the film is pretty heated, alarmist and factually incorrect. And what it does, and this is actually just from a national security point of view, American Muslims are very important allies for the NYPD, right? Because we have an awareness of a knowledge of things that the NYPD may not have. And, you know, Mr. Dickey, I think, alluded to that in terms of the Muslim officers who go undercover, but even in terms of civil society organizations. I often talk to young Muslims around the country, college students, and they're afraid. And if they know now that their conversations are being listened to, and I know that maybe my conversations are being listened to, we may not have the kind of conversations that are so important towards helping keep America safe, creating a more robust political culture, integrating different types of people. And that's a loss for national security because if in the back of my mind I'm thinking, I don't want to have this conversation because someone might take it out of context considering what the Third Jihad presents as evidence of what Islam is and isn't, then that's a loss for national security and that's a loss for New York security.
Do you feel that in day-to-day conversations with other Americans, Muslim Americans? My gosh, because I'm Muslim, I may be being eavesdropped on right now and so I should watch what I say. Do you feel that, Haroon?
Well, there was an open hall at an Ivy League university. I don't want to go farther than that in the last week. And one of the students who was there, you know, at a prestigious university, is from a Muslim-majority country. And she said, look, in my country, when the police get on you, you have a problem, right? And what she's now afraid of is that if the security, the secret police in her country find out that her institution's Muslim Students Association was being investigated by the NYPD, even if for no reason whatsoever, that puts her and her family back home in a very tight spot. Because we know that, you know, for example, we often rendition suspects to those countries because we knew what they would do to them. And so this is something that's really dangerous for American Muslims because it really affects their peace of mind, even to the extent of just kids in college who are just trying to get the best education possible.
When the net is thrown very wide, all kinds of people can end up in it. There is a role for policing here. The question that stands in with the NYPD is, where's the line? When does that become too much? Haroon Mogal, doctoral candidate at Columbia, thanks so much for being with us today. Christopher Dickey, author of Securing the City, and Jethro Eisenstein, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.